Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/arts. Just go to Indeed.com/arts right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/arts. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here, as always, to take that big stack of research, all those articles and notes you've got, and boil it all down to the essentials, the stuff you really need to know.
And today, we've got a big one, a really big one. We're diving deep into the career of O'Shea Jackson Sr. You know him, of course, as Ice Cube.
Yeah, decades long, incredibly complex career. Sometimes feel like he's lived multiple lives, honestly.
It's kind of wild when you think about it. I mean, who else has a trajectory quite like his? It's so radical, but also incredibly successful.
Right.
You look at his influence, and it's not just that he was part of cultural shifts. He was often driving them. We're talking about someone who basically helped build gangster rap.
The architect, you might say.
Exactly. Then became this really fierce political voice. Then somehow pivots into being a major Hollywood star, yep. Like bankable family comedies and stuff.
And then starts a whole professional sports league. It's a lot.
It really is. That transition alone could be its own deep dive.
For sure. So our mission today, for you listening, is to try and get a handle on these key periods of his influence quickly but thoroughly. We need to map out how his public image, his persona, evolved.
Yeah, from those explosive, really controversial beginnings with NWA through that peak political commentary period and then right into this transformation, global actor, producer, entrepreneur.
Okay, so let's start with the basics, just the snapshot. Born O'Shea Jackson, June 15th, 1969, in L.A.
Right. And he's a rapper, songwriter, actor, film producer, a true multi-hyphenate. His importance. Well, you see it solidified with things like the 2016 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction for N.W.A.
And just recently, right? N.W.A. got the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award in 2024.
That's it. So this isn't just some flash-in-the-pan celebrity. He's foundational. An institution, really.
Okay, so to really get that early fire, the revolutionary stuff in his music, we kind of have to look beyond just the NWA legend, right? Understand where he came from, his upbringing, and maybe crucially, his discipline.
Yeah, he grew up in South Los Angeles, the Westmont section specifically. Definitely a high crime area back then.
But his family background is interesting. It wasn't maybe the stereotypical story you'd expect.
Not entirely. His parents had this working class foundation, you know, focused on stability. His mom was a hospital clerk and custodian. His dad worked two jobs, machinist and a groundskeeper at UCLA.
That background feels important. It's not like immediate dire poverty, maybe, but it's about hard work, seeing the system up close, observing inequality. You can feel that fueling the early lyrics.
Absolutely. And he started writing really young, like ninth grade in high school, George Washington Prep. Apparently, he took up the challenge in a typewriting class.
Really? Typewriting?
Yeah. He actually said the rhythm of the keyboard clicks helped him figure out the rhythms for his raps. Kind of cool.
Huh. Okay. And what about the name, Ice Cube? Where did that come from? It's pretty iconic.
It's actually one of the funniest stories in the source material, I think.
Yeah.
Came from his older brother.
No.
Yeah. Apparently, his brother got fed up with him one day and threatened to, quote, slam him into a freezer and pull him out when he was an ice cube.
Just like that. Sibling rivalry.
Pretty much. A playful start for a name that ended up meaning something so hardcore, you know.
Definitely. But, okay, here's the part that really jumps out. The thing that kind of flips the script on that young, revolutionary NWA image. Ice Cube wasn't just about the music. He was practical.
Incredibly pragmatic, yeah. This is key. He seriously considered architectural drafting as his backup plan. His real career path if music didn't work out.
A backup plan. Wow. And he actually pursued it.
Oh, yeah. He went to Taft High School for it, which meant taking like a 40-mile bus ride each way every day out to the suburbs.
Yeah.
Woodland Hills, that's dedication.
That's 40 miles daily.
Yeah. Away from South Central. And it wasn't just talk. He got a diploma in architectural drafting from the Phoenix Institute of Technology in 1988.
So he was actually a certified draftsman. That implies like precision, planning, seeing the big picture, blueprinting things. Does that track with his lyrics, you think, that structure?
I think it absolutely does. That ability to see a structure, plan it out, build it piece by piece. That defines his whole career, not just the music. You see it in how dense his verses are, how he structures arguments.
And later on, we'll see it in his albums too, right? The thematic structures.
Exactly. Like with Death Certificate. The planning is meticulous. So yeah, the revolutionary fire was there, but it was being channeled by someone who knew how to draw up a plan.
Okay, but the music bug bit hard in early. 1986, he's only 16, forms a group, CIA.
Yeah, with his friend Sue Jenks. They started performing at parties, parties hosted by Dr. Dre.
Ah, the connection. Right there?
Immediate. And Dre recognized Cube's writing talent straight away. Cube actually did some ghostwriting for Dre's earlier group, World Class Wrecking Crew, helped write their hit Cabbage Patch.
So he was already writing hits, basically.
Pretty much. But the real start of NWA, the catalyst, was when he sold his first song to Eric Wright, Eazy-E.
And that sale, that track, brought the core group together and basically launched gangsta rap as we know it.
That's the story. And here's a little detail people sometimes miss. Cube was the only main NWA guy not actually born in Compton. He was from South Central LA.
Mm.
Gives him a slightly different lens, maybe.
Interesting. So you had Cube, the writer, Dre, the producer. What was that dynamic like?
Electric, by all counts. Cube wrote Boys in the Hood, Eazy rapped it, and boom. That defined the narrative. But what's really crucial about this era is just how central Cube was as the writer.
He wasn't just a rapper in the group.
No, he was the lead rapper.
Right.
And he wrote most of the lyrics on Straight Outta Compton, that iconic 1989 album.
Wow, most of it. That album was a cultural earthquake. It basically defined West Coast hip-hop's identity. Controversial, violent, but undeniable.
He was the voice, the pen, the architect, like you said.
Which makes the breakup, what happened next, even more dramatic. It all came down to money, didn't it? And respect.
Yeah. Late 1989, Cube starts asking questions. Questions about his pay, about how the group's manager, Jerry Heller, was handling things.
And the number that gets thrown around in the sources,
yeah,
it's kind of shocking.
It's staggering. He reportedly got paid only $32,000.
$32,000. For writing most of Straight Outta Compton A&D, most of Eazy-E's huge debut album, Eazy Does It.
That's the reported figure. $32,000 for helping build an empire that was making millions.
That's grounds for war right there.
It was pure exploitation, basically. Mm. Especially when you consider the profits Ruthless Records was making. And the sources say the final straw was the contract they eventually offered him. It didn't even properly list him as an official member of NWA.
Seriously, after writing all those lyrics.
Treated him like a hired gun, not a partner. So that disrespect, financially and personally, that was it.
He walks, late 89, sues Heller, settles out of court. And then the disses start flying.
Oh, yeah. NWA did not take it well. Right. They went after him hard on their next EP, 100 Miles and Runnin', and then again on the final album, Niggas for Life. Vicious stuff.
So that sets the stage, right? This intense personal anger mixed with the political fire he already had. He's got to reinvent himself. Solo.
And he does it immediately. Walks away from the biggest rap group on the planet, facing lawsuits, getting dissed. And what does he do? Drops his solo debut, America's Most Wanted, in 1990.
But not from L.A., right? He switched coasts.
Yeah, that's a really smart move. He goes to New York, works with Public Enemy's production team, the Bomb Squad, legendary producers.
Why was that so strategic?
Well, it's a deliberate step away from that West Coast G-Funk sound Dre was starting to perfect. Working with the Bomb Squad meant blending his West Coast reality rap with that dense, noisy, politically charged East Coast sound.
And it worked.
Instantly. Huge hit. It cemented his stance, you know, black nationalism, the struggle. But it also immediately drew fire. Accusations of misogyny, racism, right off the bat.
So the controversy followed him, or maybe he courted it.
A bit of both, probably. But even while he's building this solo icon status, he's also, like, putting his money where his mouth is. Community building.
How so?
He used his platform to help other artists. Most notably, the female rapper Yo-Yo, who was on his first album. He made her the head of his record label, Street Knowledge. Producer debut album.
So he wasn't just tearing things down, he was trying to build something too.
Exactly. Show he was thinking bigger than just himself and commercially. He proved he could do it alone, fast. Released the Kill It Will EP later in 1990. Became the first rap EP ever to go platinum.
Platinum EP, he was undeniably the hottest rapper out there.
No question. Which brings us to 1991, his second album, Death Certificate. And If America's Most Wanted stirred things up.
Death Certificate was throwing dynamite.
Pretty much. An outright declaration of war, politically and personally.
And here's that architectural planning again, right? The structure of the album?
Meticulous. It wasn't just a collection of songs, it was split. The death side and the life side.
What was the idea behind that?
The death side was, in his words, a vision of where we are today. Bleak, unflinching look at society, systemic problems. The life side was a vision of where we need to go. A call to action, self-improvement, based on those black nationalist ideas.
But that structure really does reflect that draftsman's mindset, blueprinting the message.
Totally. But the content, whew, even more controversial than the first album. Accusations flying, anti-white, anti-Semitic, intensely misogynistic. The tension between the message and the language was just right there. Unavoidable.
Which means we have to talk about No Vaseline.
You have to. This is his final brutal answer to NWA's disses.
And it went nuclear, attacked his old crew, but especially Jerry Heller.
Viciously. The source material is very specific about the language used. It targeted Heller, referencing his Jewish ethnicity with terms like white Jew, white man, devil, and it directly called for his murder.
Yeah, that's incredibly dark, even for a rap beef. Crossed a serious line.
The backlash was immediate and huge, obviously. But for full context, the sources also note that much later, in 2015, Cube did express regret, specifically about using the word Jew. Said his target was Heller, personally and financially, not the whole community.
Okay, that context is important, even if it came years later. There was another track on there too, right? Black Korea.
Right. Focused on the tensions between black residents and Korean store owners in South Central LA, cold racist at the time, but looking back.
It felt prophetic.
Eerily so. It basically laid out the tensions that exploded in the 1992 LA riots just months after the album dropped.
Wow. So this political firestorm leads him right into his biggest commercial success.
Exactly. The Predator, released in 1992 right after the riots, steeped in that chaos.
And commercially, this was the peak. Over 3 million copies sold in the US.
And here's the crazy stat. The Predator was the first album ever to debut at number one on both the R&B hip-hop charts and the main pop charts. Simultaneously.
First ever. That's huge crossover appeal. Without softening the message, it seems.
Not really. The song Wicked directly referenced the riots. April 29 was Power to the People, and we might just see a sequel. Capture that raw attention. And this album gave us massive hits like It Was a Good Day.
A classic. Showed a different side, too.
Yeah, calmer, more narrative, and also Check Yourself, which was more aggressive. Cemented his superstardom.
Okay, but here's the massive twist, the paradox. He hits this incredible peak number one debut, millions sold, but the sources are really clear on this.
Yeah. His original core rap audience, the political heads, they started falling off. The sources say his rap audience severely diminished and never regained the prominence of his first three albums.
So his biggest commercial success marks the point where his original fan base starts to drift away.
Essentially, yes. That's a huge turning point. It forces him to rethink things. The political edge maybe got too sharp for some, or the market just moved on to the next thing G-Funk was exploding then.
So the artist, the draftsman, had to adapt or fade away.
And Ice Cube chose adaptation, big time.
And that adaptation came fast, mainly through movies. His first big role, 1991, Boys in the Hood, playing Doughboy.
Directed by John Singleton. Seminal film. And the irony, of course, is the title comes from that first N.W.A. song Cube wrote.
He was so convincing in that role. Just embodied that character caught in the system. It gave him instant acting cred.
Absolutely. But you see his priorities shifting almost immediately. He actually turned down a big role after that. Supposed to co-star with Janet Jackson in Singleton's next movie, Poetic Justice.
Really? Who ended up getting that role?
Tupac Shakur. And it was a huge boost for Tupac's acting career. So Cube passing on that says something.
Maybe moving away from those intense dramatic roles. Or wanting more control.
Could be. Or just wanting a different image. Musically, though, he did try to follow the trend for a bit. His 1993 album, Lethal Injection.
Right, that one leaned heavily into the G-Funk sound Dre was killing it with.
Exactly. And that's kind of why it didn't fully connect with his old audience, or the critics. He was following, not leading, which wasn't his usual style.
So the reception was kind of lukewarm.
Yeah. I mean, it had hits like Bop Gun, One Nation, and you know how we do it, big singles.
Yeah.
But the sources say, after this album, that core socio-political rap audience, pretty much gone. He wasn't that voice anymore.
But old wounds started to heal a little. He worked with Dre again.
Yeah, 1984. First time since the NWA split.
Yeah.
They did the track Natural Born Collaz. Signaled that maybe that huge public beef was cooling down. Opened the door for more later.
Okay, so while his solo music thing is shifting, he's also dealing with the whole East Coast, West Coast rap beef, right? That was heating up in the mid-90s.
Fiercely. And there's this feeling on the West Coast, rightly or wrongly, that the East Coast media, the magazines, the radio, they were ignoring or downplaying West Coast artists.
So Cube decides to address this head on.
Strategically. Forms a supergroup, almost, West Side Connection, in 1995, with Mac 10 and WEC.
And the goal was explicit.
Purely ideological, really. To wave the West Coast flag, challenge that perceived East Coast bias, reinforce West Coast pride.
How'd that?
Their first album, Bow Down, in 96. It was basically a declaration of war, lyrically, very unapologetic. And it worked, commercially at least. Went platinum pretty quickly. Showed he could still mobilize that regional pride, even if the political audience had shrunk.
But the group didn't last forever.
Nah, they disbanded around 2005. And the reason why tells you everything about Cube's focus by then. There was a falling out between Cube and Mag 10.
Over what?
According to the sources, it was because Cube's Hollywood commitments were getting in the way of the group touring properly. Film had clearly become the priority over music group commitments.
Which brings us right to that Hollywood transformation. It really kicked off with advice from John Singleton.
Yeah, Singleton apparently told him, if you can write a record, you can write a movie. Simple as that.
And Cube ran with it. Co-wrote and starred in Friday in 1995 with Chris Tucker.
That movie was the pivot point. Financially, huge success. Made for like $3.5 million, grossed over $28 million worldwide. Peanuts budget, big return.
But it was more than just the money, right? The image shift.
Totally. The sources say it critically reshaped his public image into an actor. He went from Doughboy, that intense, tragic figure, to Craig in Friday. Laid back, funny, relatable. That gave him huge mainstream flexibility.
And he started directing, too.
Yep. Made his directorial debut in 1998 with The Players Club.
His film career just exploded after that. He wasn't just doing comedies, either.
No, showed range. Like Three Kings in 1999, that acclaimed war comedy with George Clooney and Mark Wahlberg. But his real genius was launching franchises, Barbershop, and the family-friendly stuff. Are we there yet? Broadened his audience massively.
So during this whole Hollywood boom, what was happening with his music? Was it just on the back burner?
Not entirely, but it felt more like checking in. Reminding people of his roots. His albums Warm Peaceful Here 1 and 2 came out then. And they featured reunions with Dre and MC Ren, slowly patching up those NWA relationships on record.
And he was doing some interesting collaborations outside of hip-hop, too.
Yeah, really smart, strategic moves to broaden his reach even further. He worked with David Bowie and Trent Reznor on a remix of Bowie's track I'm Afraid of Americans in 97.
Bowie and Pube, wow.
And then, crucially, he featured on a track with the new metal band Korn, Children of the Korn, in 98, and even joined them on the Family Values Tour.
Why Korn? That seems like an odd fit.
Genius move, though. It put him right in front of that whole alternative rock, new metal crowd, an audience that was already into controversial figures, outsider vibes, expanded his base way beyond hip-hop, which had kind of moved on from his early sound anyway.
Smart. And then he cemented that elder statesman role with that big tour in 2000.
The Up and Smoke tour. Massive. Him, Dre, Eminem, Snoop Dogg. Basically the kings of West Coast rap plus Eminem. Huge statement.
So by the time his 2006 album Laugh Now, Cry Later comes out, the music is kind of riding the wave of his movie fame.
Largely, yeah. It still did well. Sold like 144,000 first week. Mm-hmm. Had the single Why We Thugs. Proved people still listened when he dropped music, even if film was clearly the main focus.
Okay, so post-2006, Cube is firmly this mogul, right? Mm-hmm. Producer, entrepreneur. But the music doesn't completely stop.
No, it remains like a personal anchor for him, it seems. He keeps collaborating, often across different styles. Worked with crunk guys like Lil Jon and the East Side Boys. Did tracks with Insane Clown Posse, Tech N9. Keeps his hand in, stays connected.
But releasing his own albums? That got tricky. Lots of delays.
Yeah, his business interests, the film schedules, they clearly took precedence.
All right.
His 10th album, Everything's Corrupt, that was a prime example. Announced way early, so supposed to have a title track timed for an election.
For the political heads, he said.
Right. But kept getting pushed back. Finally came out in 2018. Took years. The film slate just seemed to dominate.
But that West Coast connection, that loyalty, that stays strong. He formed another supergroup recently?
Yeah, Mount Westmore. In 2020, him, Snoop Dogg, E-40, Too Short, absolute legends, titans of the West Coast, released their debut in 2022.
Hey, some girl dropping music now.
Actively. 11th album, Man Down, just came out in November 2024. And a 12th, Man Up. This is apparently scheduled for 2025. Even put out a single called Before Hip Hop. So the music drive is still there.
Okay, shifting back to the producer-director hat, he explored some interesting themes there, too, beyond just entertainment, that documentary series.
Black, White, back in 2005, co-created that. Explored race and identity by having families basically swap racial appearances. Provocative stuff.
And he directed that ESPN documentary, too, the 30 for 30.
Straight out of L.A. in 2010. That's a fantastic piece of work. It digs into how L.A. politics, hip-hop, and the Raiders football team all got tangled up together in the late 80s, early 90s.
His connection to the Raiders is deep, isn't it?
Yeah, NWA adopting that silver and black Raiders gear that basically made the team's image synonymous with hip-hop rebellion. He's a diehard fan, still is, even now they're in Vegas. Released two Raiders anthems over the years. Loves the Dodgers and Lakers, too. True L.A. guy.
And the movie franchises kept rolling, turning into TV shows, even.
All right, are we there yet?
Mm-hmm.
Became a TV series on TBS in 2010. Huge success. Got renewed for like 90 episodes. Shows his knack for building bankable properties.
And then the big one, bringing his own story full circle, straight out of Compton, the movie, in 2015.
He was an executive producer on that and made sure the story got told from their perspective. Really? That's a pretty amazing moment, seeing your story passed down like that and being involved in telling it.
Now, we talked about him walking away from NWA over principles, over money. Does that uncompromising streak still show up even now? He's a multimillionaire mogul?
Absolutely. Perfect example. 2021. He was set to star in a big comedy. Oh, hell no. It's called Step Dude Now with Jack Black. Major movie.
What happened?
He left the project. Walked away because he refused to get the COVID-19 vaccine, which the production required.
And that cost him?
Reportedly, a $9 million paycheck. Just gone.
$9 million.
Yeah. So whatever your views on that specific issue, it shows he's still willing to stick to his guns, prioritize his personal stance over a massive payday. That core cube, the guy who fought Ruthless Records,
right,
still there.
And then the most unexpected venture, maybe? Sports ownership?
Big Three.
Yeah.
Launched in 2017, professional 3-on-3 basketball league with former NBA stars.
This isn't just like a celebrity vanity project.
No, it's a legit, a successful growing league. Positions him as a serious sports entrepreneur. Leveraging his fame, sure, but also his business sense. It's that draftsman again, right?
Yeah.
Building another solid structure.
Okay, let's move into the more personal side. Behind the mogul, the rapper, the actor, what do the sources say about his personal life, his beliefs?
Well, stability seems key in his family life. He married Kimberly Woodruff way back in 1992. Still together, over 30 years, they have 4 kids. He became a grandfather in 2017.
That's a long time in any world, let alone entertainment. And how did he approach raising kids, given the content of his early music?
That's interesting. Back in 2005, he apparently said he made a point of teaching his kids to question the violence they see in all media. Not just rap lyrics, but movies, TV, everything.
So positioning himself as a media critic, not just a creator of it.
Kind of, yeah. A critical perspective on normalization.
Yeah.
Now, his religious path, that's more complex, not straightforward.
He converted to Islam.
Yes, back in 1990. Got introduced to the Nation of Islam, the NOI, through his connections with Public Enemy. Now, he denies being like an official card-carrying member of the NOI, but he definitely adopted their core ideology of black nationalism. You hear it all over his early solo stuff.
But he doesn't strictly follow one doctrine.
He describes himself as a natural Muslim. Says he listens to his own conscience because ultimately it's just him and God. Very individualistic approach.
And he's made comments suggesting a broader view, too.
Yeah, in 2017, he said something like he thinks religion is stupid, partly, but then clarified, saying he's on the Islam tip, but also the Christian tip and the Buddhist tip, kind of takes elements from different places. And he came out in support of same-sex marriage back in 2012. So definitely not adhering to a rigid dogma.
Okay. This complexity, though, it sits alongside probably the most persistent criticism he's faced throughout his career. The accusations of anti-Semitism, promoting conspiracy theories. We need to unpack this carefully, just reporting what the sources say.
Right. Impartially. The first major incident mentioned goes back to 1991, around the release of Death Certificate. At a press conference, he publicly endorsed a Nation of Islam book called The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews.
And that book makes false claims.
Yes, it falsely claims that European Jews played a dominant role in the Atlantic slave trade. Endorsing that book put him right in the middle of a huge controversy.
Then there's the No Vaseline track, which we talked about, the specific language used against Jerry Heller.
Yeah, the sources highlight the use of terms like white man, Jew, white Jew, devil, directed at Heller, alongside the call for violence. That language was and is seen as anti-Semitic.
And this issue didn't just stay in the 90s, it came back more recently.
Sharply. In 2020, he got a lot of criticism for a series of posts on Twitter over a single day. He promoted Louis Farrakhan, the NOI leader, and shared various images and memes linked to what sources describe as disproven anti-Semitic conspiracy theories.
So the same themes resurfacing decades later on a huge public platform.
Exactly, which shows those early ideological leanings were still present, still being expressed publicly.
Okay, so how has he responded to these accusations over the years? It's important to include his side, as reported.
His defense has been pretty consistent. Back in 2008, he argued he was too busy being pro-black to be anti-anybody. That's been a recurring theme.
And on No Vaseline.
As we mentioned, that 2015 statement where he regretted the specific word Jew, insisting his attack was solely on Heller personally and financially.
And the 2020 Twitter stuff.
His response then was more dismissive of the criticism, called it the hype. So he was just telling his truth. So we report the incidents, the content, the criticism, and his consistent defense, just laying out what the sources present. Hashtag tag outro.
All right, so we've traced this incredible arc, decades of Ice Cube, and the picture that emerges is just full of, well, contradictions, but also brilliant, brilliant adaptation.
Definitely. On one hand, you've got that raw, uncompromising political voice, the guy who defined early gangster rap's power and controversy. That legacy is solid Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Grammy lifetime achievement for NWA.
But then there's the other side. The incredibly pragmatic businessman, the entertainer who crossed every genre line imaginable, used his fame to pivot when his music audience shifted, and built this massive film and TV empire. Got his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 2017.
Yeah, that journey. From Doughboy's tragic reality to Nick Person's family vengeance in Are We There Yet? From being an actual draftsman to founding the Big Three League. It's like a masterclass in American enterprise, turning rebellion into a brand.
It really is the ultimate story of turning revolutionary art into durable commerce. What brings us back to that paradox we hit on earlier.
Right. The sources clearly state his core political rap audience faded after The Predator in 92, right when his commercial music success peaked. But his film career exploded right after that.
So it leaves us with a big question, really. Something for you to think about.
Does building that kind of massive, mainstream, commercially safe empire, does it always mean you have to sand down those revolutionary edges, the very things that got you noticed in the first place?
And maybe. Is that shift from writing about systemic injustice on the streets for like $32,000 to producing family comedies and running sports leagues for millions? Is that the ultimate definition of American success, regardless of what might get lost creatively along the way?
Something to chew on.
Definitely. Thanks for diving deep with us today. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.